Coming up next is the Professor James McCanney Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, December 14th, 2006, the second in the series called Ultimate Survival. Last week I talked about Velikovsky, I talked about the Kolbrin, I mentioned some other historical events and how they teach us what happened in the past, what people had to go through, our remote ancestors, to get to survive through tremendous, horrendous earth change activities. And this week I'll continue in that same vein but expand on that. I talked about what a very basic survival package would include, which would be fresh water, and in the instance that I brought up, the best thing you could take with you would be 25 pounds of red winter wheat berries. These are the whole berries which would grow, sprout. You could use it to plant and regenerate the seed crop. Organic red winter wheat, sometimes called durum wheat, the most nutritious wheat. It's something you could live on. You could sprout it and eat the sprouts and survive on that for a very long period of time. Also, you would need fresh water. But I'm going to expand on this thought this week. And I want to bring back a few pieces of history out of my own life, just to give people an idea of what I personally have done. I don't like to talk about things or topics that I don't know about personally. And as I've said before, if you see something on my webpage, if you read it in my books or see it on a video, or you hear me talk about it on the radio show, it's because I've done it myself. My research I've done myself. I don't read it on somebody else's webpage and then bring it to you. I've done these things myself. I've eaten the sprouts of the red winter wheat. I've grown it. I've experienced having failures and successes with this. I have my own water filter, something that I use every day of my life. I don't drink tap water. I have, you know, those are things that I personally do, so I'm not recommending that someone else do them because I'm just, chattering to sound good. These are things that I actually do myself. So in that vein, in that light, I want to go back to some historical incidences in my own life as I kind of was reflecting this week to a period, this was after Cornell University. I left Cornell, of course. It was a very bizarre event having to leave there, knowing that I was fully right about my theoretical work, about building the electrical nature of the solar system, the plasma discharge comet model, the galactic evolution papers, the work on Saturn that I did, the electrical nature of Saturn and Saturn's rings. All of this work was done in the 1979 to 1980-81 period when I was at Cornell, and I was publishing. I was, the problem with the physics department, and then I was in the math department successfully publishing for a year and a half, and then the physics department coming over the astronomy department and harassing them. So I left, and I came back to the upper Midwest and ended up in central Canada. And I went up into Canada in about June. Now, you have to understand, when I was a kid, I grew up in a small town, and literally walk to the edge of town and out into the countryside with my friends, sometimes by myself. And I became very secure in being by myself and how to handle myself in a wilderness situation in the countryside and not fearing that. And I'm afraid too many people today are caught in the city, depending on, you know, stores and the convenience store and the gas station and everything else you depend on, your credit cards and your bank account. And there might be a point in your life where all of this is gone. So for people who have never experienced living in the wilderness, now during my college years and post-college years, I went up many times into the wilderness by myself and sometimes spent entire summers up there studying and thinking and reflecting. And I realized that, number one, it did something to my mental attitude. I became secure with myself. I could be with myself for long periods of time and think of directions where I personally wanted to go. I spent a lot of time thinking about physics problems and celestial mechanics and mathematics problems, issues I still deal with today. I also, of course, had to confront some major obstacles, like, for example, just an example, when I was at Cornell. But when you're out in the wilderness by yourself, you have to come to grips with yourself because there's nothing else out there. And in the middle of the Canadian wilderness, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. So you have to have your head screwed on straight at all times. A small cut on your hand could be a very devastating event if it got infected or if you had other problems. Out, like a twisted ankle could become very severe if you're out on your own in the middle of no place. So you had to have you have to have your brain focused on what you're doing. You have to be experienced. And this is something, as I said, I've spent entire summers living in the woods, eating wild food, maybe carrying a bag of rice with me, and that would be it. And other than that, I had to provide all of my food from fishing or the natural resources that were in that area. I've also done this same type of living in the tropics. And so I want to bring up a couple incidents just as an example. Now, I was up in the Canadian wilderness, and there were some people probably about 6 miles away that I heard about that were out of firewood. They had no firewood and no means to get it. And there was it was kind of a desperate situation, and I heard about it. So I prepared for a day. I got food together, and what I carried with me were loaves of rye and wheat bread and probably some fish, salted fish that I took with me, that I had to carry with me. And now remember, this was in about 3 to 4 feet of snow. And it was up through ravines, 300, 400, or 500 foot elevation, walking through steep ravines, through heavy snow, pulling a toboggan with a chainsaw and a couple gallons of gasoline for the chainsaw and oil, and the sharpening tools that I would need for the chainsaw, and an axe and a splitting wedge. And I walked. I started out early in the morning as soon as I could. And, of course, the days up there only last about 6 hours. And I walked for probably 6 miles through the snow and came upon the dwelling where these people were. And they couldn't believe that someone had found them. And I then spent the night there, and many times I would live outside without a tent, without anything. This is in the middle of the Canadian winter. And the next day I spent the entire day cutting wood and chopping it and getting, and they helped, of course, getting everything ready and, cutting the limbs and getting brush so they could start the fire, making sure that they had firewood. And then I walked back the 6 miles through 3 to 4 feet of snow. And this was the kind of condition that I was in. And it wasn't just physical condition. It was mental condition to know that when I started out, I could do this and I wouldn't endanger myself and I could go complete my task and come back safely to where I was staying. And during this time, I was living outside. I didn't have a tent. I lived near a river and was bathing in the river up to the day it froze. And so my physical condition was very good. My mental condition was very good. And my spiritual condition was excellent also. These are things that you get by living in the wilderness. I also did this type of living in, as I said, in the tropics, going out, walking down the beach, miles away from anything, from any roads, just paths through coconut plantations on the edge of the beach, walking down the Central American coastline, and living off of coconuts and talking to people, meeting people that were lived in that area who had never been away from that area, who were natives of those areas, very wonderful people. No matter where you go, they would be surprised to see you, because they typically didn't see people, let alone Americans or gringos, you know, or whatever they called them. But the situation in doing these things, I learned that I can control and manage and survive. And it's not a matter of being out there and being tense. It's a matter of being out there and being confident that you can, in fact, manage these situations. And I don't know many people that have done the type of things that I've done to reach the level of confidence that I do. That's why when throughout my life, almost sometimes on a daily basis, I have to deal with adversity from that comes at me from all directions. There are people who are hired by the government disinformation crews to try and make my life miserable. And it just comes from all directions, being who I am and what my history is in the science world. And living in those situations where I was out in the wilderness by myself has made me a very strong person internally, so that I don't worry about these people. They're not an issue, and I find them to be very small, minute, kind of like mosquitoes that you swat, and they're there and they bite you every now and then. But that's what they are. They're mosquitoes. They're moths are trying to fly around a bright light. And that's the most important thing they'll ever do in their pathetic lives. But be that as it may, I wanted to talk about another issue, and that is being up in the northern world and also in the tropics at night. Now, the nighttime is a totally different world. It's one thing to be active and outside and in nature during the day or take hikes. Many people have gone to parks, and then they come back relatively soon to civilization. And they know they're going to be back to civilization, so they can plan and they can take supplies with them. How many people do you know that could drop everything they have, go to the edge of the wilderness and walk out, and for months at a time live out there without any support of any kind, without any real physical support? Now, I always talk about going into space and that the United States space program is deficient because it didn't ever develop a policy of living in space. Everything is brought up from Earth. That's not going into space. That's like going on a little day hike where you come back and then you get to go to McDonald's afterwards and everything is provided for you. The United States does not have a decent space program because they never learned how to go into space. That's not the point here. The point is we're talking about survival. And to be more specific, mental, physical, spiritual and environmental preparation and confidence that you can handle any situation. Now, I want to read just a page out of my Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. This is a 60-page supplement to the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book that came about because of just trying to explain issues over and above what that book talked about, dealing with Planet X, the many Planet X objects. And this is a chapter called What to Do. And I'm talking about survival. First of all, I talk about the 12-month period before, and then I talk about the passage. Then I talk about the 12-month period after the passage. This would be if a passage of a large celestial object through the solar system. Then I talk about long-term effects. And these are physical effects in the solar system. And then I have a chapter called What to Do. And it starts out with a quote by Charles Darwin. Darwin stated, and this is a quote, "It is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent. It is the one that is most adaptable to change." I'm going to read it again because it is so utterly important and it is so central to the idea of survival. And of course, Darwin was talking about survival of the fittest. In a sense, how do species, which includes man, make it through these tough times? Once again, Charles Darwin. "It is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent. It is the one that is most adaptable to change." And a lot of people are very rigid. They want everything just the way they have it every day. They come home, they have their paycheck, it goes into the bank every Friday, their house is, you know, they're, you know, a very nice house sometimes, or maybe not so nice a house, but it's their place. And, you know, they're everything is structured in their life. They have a place to get their food, they go buy it or whatever. But what if all of that is taken away? Whether you're the poorest person in the world or the richest, are you mentally, physically, spiritually, and environmentally prepared to handle that, to deal with that? And I would say the vast majority of people are not. If they have never gone out and literally experienced the, you know, solitude. Now, I started to talk about nighttime, and I want to recount a time down in, this was in southern Mexico one night, and I was at an archaeological dig in southern Mexico, probably around 1971. And it was in the middle of the night, and I went out, beautiful moonlit night, and there were tall palm trees near the archaeological site, and I wedged myself between them, and I climbed up between the tree, wedging myself between with my feet on one and my back on the other, and I got up to about probably 40 to 50 feet in the air, wedged between these two palm trees. And I looked up, and I had a full view around me, and I could see little animals moving, and I could see birds up in the sky, the night birds, and I could see the moon. The moon was particularly bright that night. And I just had a full view of this area. What those kind of experiences do for you, and once again, this is out in the very remote area at an archaeological dig in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. These kind of experiences give you a confidence that, number one, you were put on this planet for a reason. And number two, you have the capability of dealing with any situation that comes at you because you have somebody on your side, somebody that's a lot bigger than all of us, a lot bigger than presidents, and a lot bigger than the kings that have ruled this planet. And it's something that's in your psyche. It's something that's there, but most people don't grab onto it and develop it and realize it. It's not something that you can go out and lift weights and earn. It's something that comes from being alone, being out in the wilderness for long periods of time, where you gain confidence in who you are. This is the very important issue that I want to talk about. Now, I'm going to read some more from this chapter called What to Do. Like I said, it began with a quote from Charles Darwin, and this is in my Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. The first paragraph says, "The rest of this text will become more direct and detailed regarding what to do and how to prepare for survival based on the new understanding of what the passage really is all about." The passage, of course, referring to the passage of a large celestial object through the solar system. It goes on to say, "Remember that even the best laid plans may all be blown in the wind or washed away in a flood, leaving you with nothing more than your instincts and abilities gained in previous experiences, although nothing you have ever experienced will be anything like what is about to take place. It has already been stated that the sooner one takes his family and completely sheds the support of modern society, the better your chances of survival will be. They are not kidding when in the Bible they say, 'And the meek shall inherit the earth.' The societies that have always lived with the least resources will be the best prepared to survive. Societies have lavished themselves with the use of the most resources." Let me start this over. The societies that have lavished themselves with the use of the most resources will have the least chance to survive. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Those that have depended on medical shots to prevent disease will be the most susceptible to disease. Those who have had the best diet and grown the largest will be the hardest hit by a severely limited diet. Those who have become totally dependent on the infrastructure of modern society will be least able to cope without them." So the question, it goes on, I just want to read one little piece more. "So do not ask the question of when will Planet X arrive. If you have been reading this book, you will understand that this is an irrelevant question. That is why the government misinformation campaign is designed around giving you false information, because they can point to it and make you think that you should not pay attention to all of that crazy Planet X stuff. The reality is that they are really trying to prevent a mass movement away from their resource control, monetary control, and utility control that is keeping the populace enslaved with them as fearless leaders. That is why they try to convince you that you have to sacrifice the youth in their holy wars." So the answer to the question of what to do should already become answered, should be coming answered in your mind. The first step is to decide that society as it now stands is not for you, and that you want your offspring and future generations to know that you turned the course of history and laid a firm foundation for their futures. The introduction of Planet X types of objects will be here for everyone to deal with, but both now and in the future. Okay, so anyway, that is the first few paragraphs out of the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. And you notice that there's a theme there. Don't worry about when something's going to happen, because you don't have control over it, and that event may not happen. Something else may happen that's going to sidetrack you even worse than, say, some kind of natural disaster. It might be man-made, whatever. The point here is that if you are not mentally, physically, spiritually, and environmentally prepared, if you've never done anything like this, you're not going to fare too well at all. I always have to chuckle because I have this story I tell of a woman, a very nice woman, who a long time ago used to cut my hair, and she heard me on the radio and said, well, you know, I'm always prepared. I always have an extra can of tuna in the cupboard. And I just, you know, some of these people are very sincere and very nice, but they have absolutely no clue what survival is all about. And I've heard other people say, well, you know, we our family, they're hunters. We can shoot a deer, and they think that that is the key to survival. I even get a bigger kick out of the people who have a generator. And, you know, what is your electric drill going to be worth after a major catastrophe? These are the kind of things people are so diverted today with all of the wrong preparations for survival. The first thing you have to do to be a survivalist is to be confident with yourself and have to have gone through personal development. And that means getting away from everything, not for a day, not for a hike in the woods, not for a week camping up at the state park. I'm talking about, as I said, you walk to the edge of the wilderness, you drop everything that's in your hands, and you start walking. And you don't come back for 3 months. Are you ready to do that? And if you're not, what's stopping you from doing that? Is it because you're afraid you don't know what's out there that you might be able to eat or how you're going to keep warm? Let me talk about keeping warm. And this is something, as I said, I lived many times out in the wilderness. And I want to talk about the specific time up in central Canada, living outdoors. And as I said, I would catch fish every day. I would live off of what was available during a particular season to eat, and probably only had a bag of rice. And that's the only thing I had with me. But let's talk about keeping warm. Your body actually has the ability to keep warm. And what happens is there's actually a transformation on the surface of your, under your skin. As the temperature changes and it gets colder and colder as you go through fall and then into early winter, the blood vessels near your skin get actually smaller. It contains the blood deeper in your body. And this is a natural mechanism to allow you to stay from freezing in very cold conditions. Now, if you're used to a 70-degree climate-controlled house and you walk out to 32-degree weather and try and live outside, you're not going to do very well. But as I said, I lived outside. I wore, you know, average clothes, a wool shirt, possibly a sweater, and a parka with a hood. And activity would keep me warm. One thing I learned from people who do live in the woods and work in the woods a lot is most of the heat leaves your body through your shoulders and the top of your head. So you will find woodsmen, and they have a leather patch on the top of each shoulder and a leather cap or fur cap of some type that they wear. That contains about 80% of your heat loss right there. So there's little tricks that people learn, and of course, they're active. You don't eat as much when you're active. People who are sedentary actually eat more, which is rather odd, but that's the way it is. So living outside, I lived through February up in central Canada in the wintertime with no shelter, with no tent, and I'll add a little bit of humor here. I don't know if this is humorous, but there was a river there which ultimately froze. And at night, I would have to sleep on the lower side of a big pine tree because the moose would come crashing down through the woods at night on their way down to the river. And it wasn't just one or two moose. It was a pack of 20 or 30 moose running down through the woods. And I would hear them 5-10 feet away from me, busting branches and running down through the woods to get down to the river. where they could find something to eat. Either in the when the river was open, they would go in and eat the plants out of the river, and after the river froze, there was sunlight down there that would allow them to eat cedar boughs and other trees, tree branches, etc., that were down by the side of the river. So literally, I was living outside. There were nights when the wolves would come up 15 feet away and stand there, and we'd have a standoff, me watching the wolves, and I'd have a small light that I'd shine, and I could see their eyes, two or four or six eyes staring at me, and they would look at me, and I would look at them. And the wolves were not hungry for me. They had plenty to eat. But living in these conditions, I learned that there's a communication between animals in the woods and a communication between you and the environment. This is what I'm talking about. You have to become attuned to this, confident, and that's where you gain the self, the ability to understand who you are. And people who live in the city, I notice all around me, do not have this. I notice people who go into the woods a lot and into the wilderness have a sense about them, a confidence about them, that you don't gain from being an urban cowboy. At any rate, that's another interesting thing. If people have ridden horses, especially big wild horses like we used to ride in Mexico, you would gain an understanding of dealing with animals. There was a communication. You would, if you got on a big horse, he immediately knew if you could control him or not, and it was almost psychologically an issue between you and the horse, where you would command the reins, you would tell the horse what to do, and within 2 minutes he knew who was boss. And I've seen people get on horses who were a little timid and afraid, and believe me, that horse knew immediately that the person on his back did not have control, and the horse got nervous and did not like it. So there's a certain mental thing that can occur between animals and humans, and it's part of the person having confidence or not having confidence in themselves. Because believe me, a 2 or 3,000 pound horse is no match for a person who weighs 150 or 200 pounds. The horse would obviously, in a real tussle, would win. But the horse knows mentally that that person on his back is in control. So it's a very interesting psychological situation. And if you've never been in that situation, riding a truly wild horse, there again, that's an issue with self-confidence, of knowing that you have the ability to take those reins and guide that horse and make him run or walk or go up a steep path or go down a steep path, and he'll do that. Or when you want to stop, he'll stop and stand there, and he'll stand there until you're ready to go again. Those are the kind of issues that a person has to come to grip with. And not everybody is going to do this. I should bring up something that the military has learned through development of their troops. And this is a very interesting fact. And this has been repeated over and over again. And, of course, I'm not real in favor of the military, but there is some value to this particular fact. That is that one out of every 20 people in a group of, say, like new recruits, one out of every 20 people becomes a natural leader. And within a day or two, all of those people will look up to that one person. And for some reason, that person takes control. And he's in control. The other people recognize it. Okay, now take that person out of that group of 20, and all of the other groups of 20 people also develop their particular mental leader. You take those mental leaders out and you put them in another group, which is a more select group. One out of 20 of those people will be the leader of that group. And then you take those leaders, you bring them down into another subgroup, and one out of 20 of those people will become a natural leader of that group. And there's something about it that is, I'm not sure why the number 20 comes about, but maybe it's because it's the number of fingers and toes you have. I have no idea. But the number 20 is the number they have settled on for natural leadership. So it's very interesting that there are certain people that simply walk out of the crowd and become leaders. And I should also mention that the people who control the world today are very tuned to that, and they're the thing they are most afraid of, or one of the things they are most afraid of, are natural leaders. People who come out of the populace who simply know how to lead and are respected. The people who, like the Bushes, like the Clintons, like the other people who have gained power in other countries, they're extremely tuned to this type of person, and they many times would wait till they became more powerful and then try and so-called take them out. What's been happening more in recent history is they try to identify those people sooner and sooner in their development and take them out before they get too far. Because these are the people who are not tricked by all of their tricks, by their disinformation. These are the people who cannot be purchased or conned or bought off with all of the standard tricks used by the disinformation crew and the hoaxers who are employed by the leaders, those people who run around doing the dirty work of the leaders. They have a very difficult time dealing with these natural leaders. So once again, in a survival situation, if you had, and I've often said that 6 to maybe 10 people maximum would be the ideal size group in a survival situation. And I personally do not form groups. I never have and I never will. Sometimes people have tried to motivate me to become a leader of some type. And I simply don't do that. I do my own work. I do my own research. I am my own person, and I'm very busy involved with my own activities. So it's not like I'm going to go out and form a group, but I could give many examples of groups that formed. Some of them had between 20 and 30 people, or as many as 100 people, as many as 100 people in some cases. And the leaders of the world, the New World Order people, if you want to call them that, are extremely fearful of these natural leaders and groups that want to break away from their little controlled environment. They want you to pay your insurance. They want you to pay your house payment. They want you to live on city water. They want you to get your electricity from the electricity company. They want you to buy your gas at the prices they set, and on and on and on, and to drink fluorinated water because they say you're supposed to, and eat genetically altered food because they claim that that's better, on and on. So these are the people that will almost tell you anything. Many times they don't do this themselves, but they want the public to do it, and it's just another way, it's another tactic, one by one, to watch the evening news, to read the evening newspaper. These are all control tactics to keep people programmed from being themselves. If you are going to survive, you have to be yourself. You have to understand yourself. You have to know who you are, or you're not going to last the first day. You have to have been in situations where you're confronted with difficulties. Remember what Darwin said. It is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent. It is the one that is most adaptable to change. That means you go out You don't know what's coming at you, but you have a confidence to deal with whatever happens. You've been in situations before. I would like to bring up an example of sport, which is not one of the most popular sports in America. I would liken it to college wrestling. And I've known some wrestlers in my day, some very good ones, some of the best. And what I've understood about these people is they, when they're on the mat, it's just them and the other person. There's nobody else that's going to help them. So they have to, and they have to deal with things that come at them. They've never, in a different way, every match is different. And they have to gain a confidence that they are the superior person out there and that they're going to take care of business. So I've noticed that a lot of wrestlers have self-confidence. I'm not talking about the WWF guys. I'm talking about the real wrestlers, like the college wrestlers that are working or the high school wrestlers, because it's a sport. It's a one-on-one sport, and it's one of the toughest, most grueling sports that I can imagine, because at any rate, the point is it's development of self-confidence, and this is the same type of confidence that people need to survive. Now, in a real survival situation, I suspect that there are going to be some leaders that emerge, and we've seen this throughout history. For example, Moses, a very good example of a natural leader. And of course, we all know the story that his mother was one of the slave Israelites, and put him in a basket because she couldn't take care of him, and he floated down the river and was picked up and raised by the royalty in Egypt, always knowing that he was from somewhere else, really not understanding. But when the other shoe dropped, he became the natural leader of his people. So very interesting, the history of that person, and then what actually happened to him as the Exodus happened, as the large comet came by Earth, causing the disasters that we read about in the Old Testament, in the ancient texts, the worldwide flood, etc. Natural leaders. People who were able to go out in the wilderness and learn about themselves. And there are many other examples. You find that all of the really important natural leaders throughout history, they have one thing in common. They all went out into the wilderness by themselves for long periods of time to cleanse their mind, to get it attuned with their universe, and to realize who they were and have a confidence in who they were and what they were all about. So, now, physically prepared, I've spent a lot of time talking about being mentally prepared. And spiritually prepared is somewhat along the same line, because you have to be confident that you have been given all of the facilities, and that no matter what comes along, someone is watching over you to make you do the right thing. And a lot of times you have to turn to that higher entity and say, this is bigger than anything I know how to handle. Will you help me? And you know what? You're going to get help. I don't know how many people do that. People go around and live their life as if they're executing everything, as if they're in control of their own life. But when things get really out of hand, sometimes you have to turn to that higher source and say, this is more than I can handle. I'll do whatever it takes, but you got to be my boss. You got to be the director here. You got to talk through my speech. You have to create through my motions or activities, and I'll be very happy to work for you, but I just don't know what to do, and I need help here. And you know what? You're going to get the help you need, which is something that I have dealt with many times and seen it happen many times, not only with myself, but with other people. But let me talk about physical preparation for large-scale survival, where you are met, as I said, with nothing but your own devices. Now, here again, having spent a lot of time out in the woods and living in the woods and walking for long periods of time, I'm not a fast runner. I could never win a running race against even kids, but I have endurance. And I've been out in the woods where people come out and they've been to the gym and they work out and they're very fit, physically fit. And you get them out into the woods for one day and they're dragging. They can't keep up with a 60-year-old man walking through the woods. And they go, how do you do that? How can you possibly, you know, keep doing and moving and going all day like this, and they're just dragging? And how can you do this without eating three times a day? Physically fit is something very different when you're in a survival mode. It's very different than going to the gym or running or jogging or any of the other exercises that we commonly talk about in this modern life we're living in. Physically fit, you have to couple it with mentally fit. You can become exhausted by mental fatigue faster than physical fatigue. So just the fact that, for example, in a survival wilderness environment, you don't have pavement to walk on. You're not jogging on a nice flat surface. How many people go out and jog through the woods where you have rocks and branches and tree stumps and holes and dips in the ground? It's a very different exercise than jogging for 2 miles on a flat pavement, where every step is perfectly aligned with that flat surface. And there's a mental connection with this when you're in the wilderness. There's an ability to associate with what's around you and be confident that you can deal with whatever is coming your way. And it's the same way with walking. So, let's say getting firewood or getting prepared or sleeping properly. All of these things contribute to your physical and mental stability when you're in the wilderness. If you're used to your nice warm bed with your, you know, the air conditioning on or whatever, or the climate controlled or the furnace on, then how are you going to exist out in the wilderness when you have none of these and you're trying to survive and you need food and all of the things you have to do on a daily basis to survive, everything you're used to, they're simply not there. So the four things I've talked about mentally, are you mentally stable with yourself? Are you physically capable of dealing with an environment that is not absolutely pristine with flat sidewalks and, in the gym where you have the right temperature and you're lifting weights or working on one of the machines, and you go home and you feel good, but are you really physically fit relative to being in a stressful survival situation? The answer is no. It's a very different type of physical capability. And spiritually, are you confident in yourself that you can ask for help and get that help? How many times have you done that and asked for help, received the help, and said, this really works? How many times have you done that in your life? Or environmentally prepared? How many times have you lived on sprouts from sprouting your own seeds for 1 or 2 or 3 weeks at a time? How many times have you gone without that trip to the restaurant or your credit card to buy food or the grocery store or the convenience store, whatever it is? How long have you gone without these? How long have you gone without being in your own kitchen with your refrigerator and all the conveniences of home and the boxed food or the canned food in the cupboard? How long have you been away from all of this? As I said, step up to the edge of the wilderness, drop everything in your hands, and walk out there. Don't come back for 3 months. Can you do it? Can you even imagine it? And I don't expect people to actually do this. It would be good. And I've always said something after teaching students. I've been involved with students. Half of my career has been teaching students. And I've watched kids grow up and friends' kids. And, you know, I have one belief. And that is that after high school, not college, but after high school, every student, I don't care if they're an A college-bound student or if they're the D student who's flunking out and only is going to go into the military or going to go flip hamburgers at McDonald's. I don't care what student you're talking about. Every student should be required to take a one-way ticket. You draw these tickets out of a hat. One-way ticket to a third-world country with no money or no means of support. And you have to earn your way back by living in that country, speaking the language, and living with the poorest people in that third world country. Do you want to bet this country would be a very different place? You wouldn't have the kids going to college with mom and dad paying for it, and it's just the advanced babysitting job for a lot of kids. And the party and all of that, and then they get out and they get the job and they get the nice car and the stereo and the apartment, and then they get married. And their view of the world is so distorted, they have no idea what's going on in the rest of the world. When they go on vacation, they go to Mexico, they go to Cancun, and they stay at a 5-star hotel and they think they've been to Mexico. Or they go to Europe, or they go to Latin America, or they go to Southeast Asia, to the resorts there. And they think they've been to those countries. And just a few miles away, there are people living in dire poverty, and they don't even know it. They've never seen it. I remember seeing people for the first time when I'd take them someplace, and they saw real poverty for the first time. They saw it face to face. They didn't see it in a picture or read about it in a book. They were face staring at it face to face. The look on their face, because they never imagined what it was really like to see poverty, utter poverty in a third world country. So, once again, can you imagine all of a sudden having everybody around you, everybody you know, everybody who is rich, everybody who lives in a beautiful house and golfs every weekend or flies to the Southwest on a regular basis for the golf tours or whatever, stays in the nicest hotels, down to the average person who takes his family on a family vacation once a year. Can you imagine all of these people all of a sudden without a thing left, without any infrastructure, without a grocery store to go to, without supplies of any kind, without clean water? Can you imagine what you would look around and see? Can you imagine the looks on these people's faces, the distress, the disbelief that this could happen, and the utter lack of information in their heads as to what to do? This is something I personally envision, because I've been in the poorest countries in the world. I've seen poverty. I've lived with the people in those very poverty-stricken areas. And I realized one thing, that not only are they happy people, but they are people that are confident that tomorrow they're going to wake up and they're going to be able to find something to eat. They're going to have someplace to sleep, and they're going to get through it, and they're going to be happy. Happiness is one of the most elusive creatures in modern life. People think that if they get that new TV or that new plasma screen or the new video game or the new Xbox or the new whatever, that that's going to bring them happiness. Go to a third world country where people have nothing, they've never seen anything like that, and that having a little piece of bread with some sugar on it brings them happiness, because that's all they have. That's the best thing that's happened to them in a couple weeks. Can you imagine such a thing, looking around at everybody around you and realizing that they are all, they've lost everything that they had? Can you imagine the look on people's faces, and can you further imagine what they would do to survive, to take care of themselves? Well, how many would expect the government truck to drive up in front of their house with a supply of goods so they could continue living in some manner similar to the way they were living before? How many people would actually expect that and think that such an event would happen, that somebody is out there that's going to just drive up to your front door, bringing you fresh water and food and clothing, and fill your car with gasoline and give you tickets to the baseball game or the football game? People are so clueless as to how to live through a situation. I know countless people who don't even think about this. It is not something that goes through their mind on a daily basis or ever. As far as they're concerned, life is going to continue on and on and on. Gas prices might go up, but as far as they're concerned, everything is going to be exactly like it is now forever. And they believe that things have been like this into the far distant past forever. They have no idea what their ancestors, the pioneers, went through even 100 years ago. They may have read about it in a history book and saw a picture of a covered wagon, but that's about as far as their imagination can stretch, not realizing what people went through just 100 years ago, let alone 500 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, or 4,000 years ago. They have no idea where they came from, or who they are, who their ancestors were, or what they had to deal with, and as a result, they've gotten very far away from being the human race that they really should be. The human race now is centered around being, building new houses and, having all of the modern convenience. China wants to be like the United States. There's simply not enough wood in the world for everybody in China to have a house in the suburbs. So on and on. I'm stressing this topic because it is so absolutely important. I want to spend just the last half minute here talking about the recent solar flaring. Of course, this past week, we've had multiple major solar flares, X3 to X9. These are the highest level flares. And as I present this show tonight, we are in fact involved in one right now. There's no way of knowing exactly how severe it is. By tomorrow, we'll probably have all of the data in. But once again, this could affect, and once again, I don't have all the data in regarding today's solar storm or the possible power outages or earth-wide effects, satellite outages, those type of issues. But just watch my webpage for further updates on that topic, the solar flaring going on this week. And once again, I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.